is resolved to follow God, and it's from the book of Daniel, chapters 1 through 6. Now, don't worry, we're not going to read chapters 1 through 6. What I'd like you to do this week, as you have time, is go through and read those six chapters of Daniel. Daniel is separated into two sections. The first six chapters are a narrative and a historical of Daniel's life. The chapter 7 through the end are prophetic chapters with some history spread throughout in it. But what I want to talk to you is I'm going to tell you four stories in this six chapters. We're not going to go into full detail of the four stories because that would just take a lot of time. But what I want you to see in these four stories is how these four men in these four stories are resolved to follow God in all ways. And you'll see it's divided into two. The first two stories is called Small Temptations, and there's two stories there. They seem like minor events, but you'll see that later on in these men's lives, these two stories of small temptations, they're able to learn and earn and develop their resolve to follow God when they are pressured to conform to the world around them. The world expects you to change, to be like the world. We're pressured to conform to this world, to be like it, not just to accept the world, but to be like the world. We see it more and more in our society. We're pressured to accept lifestyles. We're pressured to accept differing views on religion. In fact, we're called bigoted and hateful if we don't hook, line, and sinker love the world. But we are called to be Christians in every situation. Now, it's very clear that we understand through these examples that not agreeing with someone does not mean to be ugly to them and always be arguing and combative. You can respectfully disagree with the world and still be kind to those around. You can respectfully not conform to the world and still show a good Christian witness to those around. So not conforming doesn't mean you're battling with people constantly in arguments and conversations and getting boisterous and in someone's face and debating all the time. That's not what this means. It just means having an inner resolve to honor God in all of your ways. So we're going to tell the story of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You know them as Daniel, which is also Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In all of their ways, the honor of God, following God's law, complete worship of God, these three things were constantly at the center of their agenda. So let's start in the first story, and this is in chapter 1. This is one of those smaller temptations. In chapter 1, let me just give you the narrative of what happens here. Judah is overtaken. King Jehoiakim is the last real king in Judah before they are in continual exile and chains and prisoners. So a powerful, powerful man of the Chaldeans named Nebuchadnezzar comes and he conquers Judah. Now Nebuchadnezzar and his army are massive. They're huge. They destroy everything in their wake. Now what they don't do is go just capture, replace the king, and then take tribute. Because the people might still have a little bit of will and resolve to revolt. What they would do is they would decimate your society. They would destroy your buildings. They would destroy everything that made you, you. You see that Nebuchadnezzar ransacks the temple. He takes all of the vessels in the holy temple and takes them out. And he takes them not just to his house, but as a slight against the gods of the people that he would conquer, he would take their religious vessels and put them in his places of worship to honor his gods. What he wanted to do is completely annihilate your identity. So he would decimate the cultures, just completely destroy them, and just leave this little scattering of people there. So one thing that he would like to do is he would take from these cultures, from these cities and kingdoms that he would overpower, he would go to the royal household. Now all of these kingdoms in those days, in the royal household, when someone was king, their relatives promoted with them. So in the household, you would have the king's nephews, cousins, brothers, close relatives, or close friends as advisors, magistrates, positions of power where they're able to make a little bit more money, have a little bit more wealth, live in a nicer house. And Nebuchadnezzar knew that. So what he would do is he would take the teenage boys of the royal household, and his purpose was to take them away so that they couldn't grow up then to rule the kingdom again in revolt. He would take all their future leaders, take them all out, and he would bring them to his own household. But he was very specific in who he requested. Now, all of the royal households were typically more educated because they were able to have tutors, they were able to learn the language, they could read, and he knew this. So he's taking the smart people, the smart teenage young men from whatever kingdom, from Judah, taking them to his house. But he also wanted them to be of the royal household, relatives. But then there was another one he really wanted. They had to be good looking. So, in other words, he took the cream of the crop of the teenage boys from Judah. He took the well-connected, the well-established, the wealthy, smart, good-looking teenage boys from Judah. Typically, they're aged 13 to 16 or 14 to 17. And he would put them in a rigorous training program in his house for 3 years. And what he's doing in these 3 years is he's training them to teach his language, to know the history of his kingdom, and to worship his gods. So he's taking them, young, impressionable teenage minds, and he's going to take the brightest, best-looking, smartest guys and turn them into his own counselors. And what they would do is if they graduated his program, then you would then go before the king. He wouldn't look at you for those 3 years. You'd come before the king, and he would talk with you. And he would take the best of all of that group, and he would put them in his palace. They would be messengers. They would be advisors. They would be counselors, because these were smart guys. They knew what they were talking about. And in Chaldea, he didn't have just Chaldeans ruling his kingdom. He had men, the smartest and brightest of the world, running his kingdoms and his towns and his cities. And that's his goal with these guys. So what he does is he takes these. Now, there's a big group there, but you only hear of four names because these four stood out. So what they were to do is the chief eunuch or the chief butler of all the king's house, he would take all these men and he would get them Chaldean clothes, and they would eat the king's very food, his wine and his meat. I mean, they're getting good treatment here because he wants them to get ingrained in his society. He wants them to love being part of his kingdom. But four young men stand out because it says that they were resolved. They were purposed in their heart. In verse 8 of chapter 1, Daniel purposed in his heart. That means he had an inner conviction that he was going to do something. He was going to honor God. Now, this is a small thing. What it's talking about here is the king was going to give them his meat and his wine to drink. So that's such a big deal. The easy version here for these four young men is just simply eat the meat, drink the wine, blend into the new society, keep their heads down, and not get noticed. But what they do is they're resolved for one thing, not to stand out. That's not their resolve. Not to get noticed, or purposed to honor God. Because the eating of the meat and the drinking of the wine was in a violation of God's law. It wasn't necessarily just the meat. They couldn't eat certain meats. But what this meat was in Nebuchadnezzar's household is it was sacrificed to his gods. And his wine was given as an offering to his gods. And then it was brought into his home to eat and drink. There's the problem. This is a violation of God's law for these four young Judean men. They're resolved in this very small matter of eating some meat and drinking some wine not to disobey God's laws. Now you got to think. The world around them has changed. They came from Judea, which was not a huge place, to Babylon. Babylon was massive. It said that the walls were almost 80 feet thick. And 65 miles long. It was a massive, huge city. It had everything. All the glamour, all the glitz, all that the eye could want. And you can just imagine a group of teenage boys coming to this big, massive city with everything they could desire. And in fact, it's handed to them on a platter. Here you go. You can have this. You can have this. You can have this. Just conform. So all around them is this just overwhelming glamour and power, but yet these four young men are resolved to still honor God in all of their ways. So what did they do? Now, what they did not do is get a picket sign and posters and go out protesting, eating the king's meat and drink. And on this side, you got four young men protesting against meat and drink. On this side, you got all the rest protesting for it. No, they privately petition. Now, you may have situations in your life where you're going to be asked to do something that is ungodly. The way that we petition is important, and we've learned that here. They did not, in front of the whole group, start arguing with the chief eunuch. They simply petitioned respectfully that they be allowed not to do that. Well, he's not going to let them. So he assigns each of these groups of men to another eunuch. And they have a eunuch named Melzar, and he's in charge of them. So again, they privately, respectfully petition Melzar. They're like, please don't make us drink this wine or eat this meat. He's like, guys, I'm going to get my head chopped off if you don't do this, because what's going to happen is you're going to get sickly and frail, and I'm in charge of y'all, and the king's going to get mad because I didn't take care of you, and I'm getting my head chopped off. So Daniel, very full of wisdom here, says, well, then just give us 10 days. Now, this is a 3-year period of training that they're supposed to be doing. He says, just give us 10 days. Just give us vegetables and water and try us for 10 days. Well, the eunuch says, well, that sounds like good reason. I'll give you 10 days, Daniel. So these four young men eat just vegetables and drink just water for 10 days. At the end of those 10 days, the eunuch sees them and compares them to all the other young men. And they are brighter complected, fatter. In other words, they're the healthiest in the entire group. And so he says, you know what? We're going to keep on with this. So after their period is done, they get to go before the king. And what happens with these four young men before the king? They stand out. Their whole goal in the beginning was not to stand out. That's why they petitioned privately, quietly with the eunuch, in a respectful way. They didn't want to bring attention to themselves. They weren't out to make a big show. They just simply wanted to honor God in all of their ways. And the result was the king noticed them above all the others, especially Daniel. And he saw the wisdom in Daniel. And he saw his smartness. And he said, you know what? These guys are going to be part of my court. So in these very small ways, in this small temptation, the easy thing would have been what? Just eat the meat, drink the wine, call it a day, be like everybody else. But even in this very small thing of just eating meat and drinking wine, they're still resolved to honor God. Now, would anybody have noticed in that whole group, would they have looked there and like, Daniel's eating meat. Daniel's drinking. They were all doing it. Nobody noticed. You know what they did notice? Daniel's drinking water and eating vegetables, not the meat and wine. Daniel's goal wasn't to say, hey guys, look over here. Look at what I'm doing. I'm going to be a little more holy than you. That's why these four quietly and respectfully petition. But what ends up happening is trying to not be noticed and just trying to honor God did bring them into a bigger light and a bigger standing. They stood out above all the others. Now, let's move to the second story. This is in chapter 2. This is called Humility to God. So you still have these four young men. This is after their training 3-year period. They're now brought into the king's court. But they're still young. They're just young adults. They're 20, 21, around that age, something like that. And so the king is having them do things, but he doesn't call them to all of his big important things. So something happens. Nebuchadnezzar has an absolutely impossible task for all of his wise men. He has a dream, and it troubles him so. He's very disturbed and upset. He wakes up and he calls all of his main wise men. Get the wise men of my house. Now, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not included in this group yet because they're like junior council at that time. They're still in their home. So he gets his wise men, his Chaldean wise men, and he calls them to his room. And he is troubled. And he's like, you know what, guys? I need something. I've had this horrible dream. I want you to interpret it for me, and I will reward you. Like, okay, great, king. What is your dream? He's like, no, not so fast. Tell me what my dream was, and then interpret it. Well, the wise man, like, it's ridiculous. I probably really don't even know what your dream means. I was going to make it up anyways, but now you want me to tell you what you dreamed? There's no way I can make that up and be right. That's a ridiculous ask. So Nebuchadnezzar gets, as he typically did, very irrational. Fine, you can't tell me what I dreamed. I'm going to cut all your heads off. In fact, I'm not just cutting your head off. I'm going to go through this whole kingdom and I'm finding every wise man and every counselor and I'm cutting their heads off too because you can't do my impossible task. Well, Daniel and his band of brothers aren't even in this group. They're at their home. Captain of the guards, yes, sir. I'm going to go chop everybody's heads off. If they're a wise man, a counselor in your court, cutting their heads off. They get to Daniel's house, knock on the door. He comes to the door. Yeah, it's going to help you. Well, I'm here to cut your head off, Daniel. Daniel says, well, why? And here's what happens. And this goes back to Daniel's standing out in the first story. Daniel had learned to be respectful in his circumstances. He had learned to make relationships with the people of the kingdom. Now, was he bending to their laws? No. But Daniel was able to talk man to man, face to face with someone who completely disagreed with him on religion because he did it in a respectful way. And it helps him in this case. He petitions again in a respectful way with the guy who was sent to cut off his head. And he says, I tell you what, would you please petition the king to let me try? Well, the guy looks at him. He probably knew who Daniel was because Daniel stood out about above all the others to the king. So if the king notices somebody, the captain of his guard is going to notice them as well. So sure. So he goes to the king, says, Daniel would like to try. King says, okay, bring him here. Daniel says, king, if you would give me time, I would like to go pray with my brethren over this. The king's like, great, I want you to go do that. So what does Daniel do? He goes back to the home with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he doesn't start to complain about this ridiculous society we live in, these impossible tasks that were being asked. He simply goes and says, there's a task and we need to pray. So what do these four men do? They pray. They pray that God would give them wisdom. They pray that God would be glorified and God would be magnified and God would give them wisdom. Well, God gives Daniel the interpretation and the dream. He shows him what the dream was and he shows him what it meant. You know what Daniel does? He doesn't say, guys, y'all stop praying. I've got this. Me and God. Daniel goes to his brothers and he says, let's pray. God has shown me. And in his prayer, he thanks the Lord for showing them collectively what it meant. He didn't say, Lord, I thank you that you have blessed me above my brethren to give me the gift of interpretation. He prays with his brothers. I believe that's in verse 23 or 22 of chapter 2. Yeah, in the end of it, he says, thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. Daniel was in fellowship with his brothers. The brothers were in fellowship with Daniel, and that's going to play on in a later story. These men were ingrained together with resolve to follow God. You know what they had done? They had found like-minded Christians, like-minded people that they could be closely knit together with. You know what's going to happen in this type of situation they were in? It's the same type of thing we're going through now. When you go to work in the corporate workplace, you're being pressured to conform to the world. This is June. I'm sure if you're at work or if you've been on LinkedIn or any social media, you see what June is. It's a pride month for a sinful lifestyle. And is being promoted and pushed in your face nonstop. Now, is our response to go up to the corporate president and say, I oppose. I will not be a part of this. That'd be nice. Yeah, I'd love to do that. It's not going to win me anything. It's not going to win me favor. It's not going to win me friends. And it's not going to change the course of things. You know what happens is these small little things of getting together with other Christians and praying is where the differences start. You know what you can do at work and you're in those situations? You find like-minded Christians. You know what? They're out there. There's a lot of Christians in the workforce that want someone to commune with, that want someone to pray with, that are desperately in need and desiring God like-minded people to commune with at work. They're there. Find them. Meld with them. Get with them. Pray with them. You're not alone. As Isaiah found out, he thought he was alone in the world. And God says, you're not, Isaiah. There's 6,000 people out there. You're not alone at work. There are people who want to honor God. Be with them. Commune with them. Have a relationship with them. And that's what is happening here. Daniel immediately goes to his three closest companions and says, we've got to pray. And they pray. And God honors their prayer. And Daniel thanks the Lord for honoring that group of men by answering the prayer. So then he goes to Nebuchadnezzar. He says, this is through verses 24 through 45, he tells the king what his dream is. Exactly what he dreamed, because God had showed him. And then he tells the king exactly what the dream means. Now, we're not going to get into all the meanings of these dreams. These are all prophetic. These are different sermons. We're not getting into the meanings. The point is, God showed Daniel what the dream was without him having a clue other than a crazy man dreamed something. And then he told him exactly what it meant. So Daniel goes to the king and he tells him. Now, in verse 45... we'll see that. Let's just read verse 45. Forasmuch as thou sawest that the stone was cut off the mountain with hands, and it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. The dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. Now, Daniel had a perfect opportunity to promote himself to the king. He could have said, King, I know exactly what you dreamed, and I know exactly what it meant. You might want to keep me around. I'm a pretty smart guy, and I know what you're thinking. He had a perfect opportunity here to go promote himself. But Daniel humbly points back to God. He says that God has shown you this dream, and God has shown you what it means. Daniel's not out to self-promote himself. Daniel's goal was to promote God and to live for God. Daniel didn't want to be noticed. That wasn't his goal, and you'll see that here in a minute. So with humility, he points back to God instead of to himself, because his one goal in his life is to follow God and to live for God. Now this matters because in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar calls on someone when he has another dream. Who's the one person you think he'd call on? The only guy who he knows will know what he's talking about. But it's very important. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't say, Daniel's the smartest guy out here, go get him. Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 18, he knew that Daniel was a man of God. And he knew that the Spirit of God was in Daniel. Daniel's resolve to point back to God in that first dream, it let Nebuchadnezzar know that there's something more about Daniel than just Daniel. The Spirit of God is with Daniel. I want that guy to tell me what my dreams are, because it's God telling me through him. Daniel's resolve in the small things helps him later in the bigger things. And then again, so Nebuchadnezzar dies. 20 years later, something else happens. He dies and Belshazzar becomes king. 20 years after the interpretations of the dreams, and 20 years after Belshazzar becomes king, something else happens. He's having this big party. He goes and gets all the holy vessels that were stolen from the temple, and he comes out and brings them out and has a big old party with them, defiling God's holy vessels. So God, in his hand, writes on a wall. And everybody's scared. There's an invisible hand writing on a wall, and nobody knows what it means. Well, Belshazzar is scared. Somebody else remembers something, though. It says that the queen, which was likely Belshazzar's mother, the queen remembered Daniel, and that God, the Spirit of God, was with him. And she says, son, or king, there's someone who can interpret what this means, because she remembered something that happened 20 years ago with a certain man who the Spirit of God rested with. And Daniel, of course, comes in and interprets, like, hey, Belshazzar, it's destruction. You're about to die tonight. And he's like, okay. He dies, of course. The whole point is, his acts in pointing back to God in the first interpretations of the dream brought about a second time, and they say, God is with you. What does this mean? And 20 years later, God is with this guy. What does this mean? He brought God honor in the small things in his life. Now let's move to this is a little choppy with the four stories, but you'll see how they all come into play. Now those are smaller things. It's eating meat and drinking wine. Young, impressionable teenagers, but still they're resolved. Well, then it's just the small thing of taking the credit when you could have. for the interpretation of a dream, but he gives the glory back to God because his whole purpose is not to promote himself, but to bring God honor. Well, then the big things come, the big trials. Now, it's important to put the little trials and how they prepare you for the big trials that are to come. So our next section is called pressure to conform, because it's out there. We're being pressured right now to accept sin in the workplace, in our home, in the schools, and how we raise our children. It's out there. We're being pressured to accept it, to conform. The rest of the world is doing it. What is wrong with you? You stand out like a sore thumb. Just get on board. This is the new us. This is what you need to do. Well, in chapter 3, we see that everyone else is more than willing to go along with the silliness that King Nebuchadnezzar once again comes up with. He wants a massive statue built in his honor. So big that if you're standing at the foot of it, you can't see the top of it. It's massive. And what he really wants is not just that big statue. He wants everybody to worship that statue because it represents him. And if you'll bow down to my statue, you're going to be bowing down to me and saying that I am God. So he calls all the people in Babylon together. He says, you're going to gather before my big statue, and I'm going to play this fanfare music, trumpets, all you can think of. We're going to blast it out, and what's going to happen is when that music blasts, every one of you is going to bow down and acknowledge me as God. Everybody got it? Simple? Yes, sir, we got it. Not a problem. You're God. Everybody starts bowing. Thousands of people. You know what the easy thing to do is there? It's like, oh my goodness. I'm going to bow real quick, get this over with. Nobody saw. It's okay. I didn't mean it. I'm not really worshiping. I just want to get through the day. We ever been there? I just want to get through the day. I want to get through this conversation. It's not a big deal. I don't really mean this. I don't want to argue. I don't want to have this conversation. I'm just going to say what they want to hear and move on. You been there? It's easy to do that. What's hard is say, you know what? I can't agree with you there. You know, I can't do this. I serve a God who I worship. And this is blasphemy to him. I can't do this. That's when it starts getting hard, because then people start getting in your face. Then people start pointing at you. Well, what do these three men do then? This is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It doesn't tell us where Daniel is at this point. That's not part of the story. It doesn't tell us where he is. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are resolved to do something. They would not bow in worship. Three guys out of thousands. The easy version is just get on your knees and get through the day, guys. Stop causing a scene. Now we all have to stand here longer. So you know what the king does? King remembers them. He remembers these three guys because they stood out with Daniel. Daniel stood out above all, but these three were part of Daniel's band, and the king remembered. So he calls them to him because somebody says, hey, there's three Jews over here that won't bow. Bring them here. Now, if it was most people, he probably would have just cut their heads off right then. But I believe that King Nebuchadnezzar knew who these three men were because they were influential. Everybody knew who they were because of Daniel and their resolve. They're making a reputation for themselves in a good way. So here's what the king does. He gives them a second chance. This is your chance to save face. I know you probably didn't mean what you just said, Christian. How about you take that back? Just, you know what? Just agree with us here. It's okay. I know you don't really mean those bigoted things you're saying. Or know that you really don't mean to be so hateful in your condemning of my sin. Just, how about you tone down your rhetoric a little bit, Christian? Can you do that? These things like, you know, I didn't really mean what I said. It's, you know, these guys have a chance to get with the program. These guys have a chance to finally get with the times. You know what? You're not in Judah anymore. You're not at your holy temple anymore. You're in Babylon. This is the new place. This is it. This is a new life. Come on, just get with the program. And they're given this chance. And the king says, we're going to go back out and play the music. And when you hear it, I want you to bow down. But if you don't, I'm going to destroy you in a fiery furnace. Now, kids, we sing the song about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were not getting thrown into the fire pit back there. They were not getting thrown into a bonfire. If you go start doing some research on these furnaces in Babylon, some of the furnaces were the size of a city block. That is massive. Remember, Babylon is huge. If they're going to do it, they do it big. So if you just want to say it was a smaller furnace, take this sanctuary and put a big fire in this whole sanctuary. This fire was so big and so hot that the guys that were tasked with making it hotter died because it was so hot. They couldn't even approach this blazing furnace without dying because of the heat coming off of it. If you don't want to bow this time, if you don't want to get with the program, Christian, you're going in that. What is their response here? They know what's coming. They know the extreme danger that they're in. But God was at the very center of their everything. From the small things of not eating meat and drink, to the big things of honoring God when their life was on the line. They were resolved to follow God in every area of their life. That means at home. That means with your family. That means when you're alone. That means when you're in public. Everywhere they were resolved for one thing and one thing only. To follow God in the face of everything that was coming. Worship and honor of God at all costs. Let's hear what they say to the king in their response. Chapter 3, verse 17. So the king speaks to them. He's like, come on, guys. Serve my gods. If not, you're going to go into the fiery furnace. And here's what they say. Let's go to 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. And they're not being rash. They're not jumping to some conclusion. They're not getting in his face and being disrespectful. What they're saying is, we have thought this through. We are very resolved in what we're about to do. And we will not budge. And they say, if it be so, our God who we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of thy hand, O king. We serve the God, the one and true God who can do all things. So if he wants to rescue us from you, he will. If it be so, but if not, in verse 18, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. What are they saying? It doesn't matter whether God saves us or doesn't save us. He may, but if God chooses not to, and I know that the destruction that you're promising me, if I know that it's still coming, I still, even then, am resolved to follow God. Now, we haven't been put in that situation, most of us here. Probably none of us. To the point of death for God. But you know what? There are people right now in this world that are facing that very thing. And they're showing resolve for God in the face of execution, in the face of having their churches burned down and beaten alive in front of their burning churches. They're resolved to follow God because God is their everything. He is at the very core and center of their entire agenda in every aspect of their life. Because if it were not so, they would flee, they would scatter, they would deny. But it's happening today. It may come to us. I don't know. I hope to God it doesn't come here. But are we, as a people here in comfortable America, in conservative Alabama, ready to be resolved for God even unto death? It seems extreme. It does. It seems extreme to us right now. It happened to them and it's happening today. Are you resolved to follow God in every aspect of your life. And we know the end of the story. God saves them. The king looks out. He said, didn't we throw three men in? Now there's four. One is if it's a son of a god. And then he pulls them out and he starts worshiping and praising God. We know the end of that story. But the point is, they were resolved to go into that fire and die. Now they believed God could save them. But they also had enough faith to know that if God did not save them, they were still resolved to die for God. Now let's go to our fourth and last story. This is in chapter 6. It's called Much to Lose. So at this point, King Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar has died. This is after the handwriting on the wall. He's died. He's been conquered by the Medes. And this is where Darius comes in. Now, there's a lot of debate that Darius is actually Cyrus, and Darius the Mede was actually a title. I'm not going to go into that debate. It's Darius right here, so we're going with Darius. So King Darius comes in. Now, just imagine, Babylon is huge. The Chaldeans are massive. They destroy everybody. Well, now somebody comes in and destroys them. This is the Medes. That's power right there. They come in and just destroy the most powerful kingdom. Now they're the most powerful kingdom by 10 times. So this is 60 years that Daniel has been in Babylon at this point. So if he comes in as a mid-teenager, Daniel is probably in his early to mid-70s at this point. He's a seasoned, wise man. He's lived through many situations, as we've seen. Now, what is very important here is that Darius knows who Daniel is. How does Darius know who Daniel is? He just came in and conquered this place, and that's just an old guy. Because the people of Babylon know who Daniel is. The ambassadors that probably came from the Medes know who Daniel is, because since Daniel was a teenager, he stood out to the king. He was the wisest man in Babylon, and the king knew it. And they all knew, as happened right before the Medes come in, Daniel is the one who they remember. He's got the Spirit of God with him, and he knows what that handwriting says. And here's why I say that. Daniel is immediately placed into a position of power. So when Darius comes in, he divides up all of this kingdom. And he's like, Darius isn't going to rule the whole kingdom by himself. That's impossible. He needs people he can trust to be smart enough and wise enough to run it for him. So he sets up 120 satraps. It's kind of like governors or mayors or something. 120 of those. And then he picks three governors that will rule over the 120 satraps. One of those governors is Daniel. This made him hated. People hated Daniel. Who was this old Jew coming in over here to start telling us what to do? I should have been in that position. I'm a Chaldean. Or I'm younger. I'm smarter. I should have been in that position. So Daniel automatically has enemies. But people already hated him because he stood out, because he had character, because people knew that he was a man of character and a man of God. So they hated him already. And then all of a sudden he's put into this position of power. This made him an easy target, because what Darius decides to do is, I think I'm going to make Daniel vice regent. He's over the three governors. I'll put somebody else as a governor, and now he's in charge of everybody. The only person more powerful than Daniel is the king. I think that's what I'm going to do. They're not having it. Those satraps and those other governors are like, I am not having this. So they concoct a plan to destroy this man. Daniel is an easy target for them. Daniel is easy because he is a man of principle. Principled men don't bend. Principled men with character for God do not bend with the times. They're not easily swayed to the world. They're not easily manipulated in the world. They're not easily bribed, because they're men of character. And they did not want a man of character with the Spirit of God resting on him being in charge of them. So he's made himself an easy target here. His enemies knew his resolve for God. This tells you something else about Daniel. From the very beginning, Daniel was resolved to follow God as a teenager. Now he is in his 70s, and people still know one thing about Daniel. Daniel is resolved to follow God. So for 60-something years, Daniel has garnered a reputation of following God. We know that because that's the one thing they know they can attack him on and win. They cannot say he's taking bribes. They cannot say he's corrupt. There's only one thing that they know for sure that they can get Daniel on, and that is his resolve for his God. That stands out. That's the one area of his life that they know for sure is not changeable, is his resolve to follow God. He specifically attacked on his religion. So what they do is they say, King, we need a new law. It's a great law, King. Let me convince you why. Because it's going to make you more powerful. It's going to bring you much more honor. What we want, King, and it's just because we love you so much. It's because you're such a great and benevolent King, Darius. We really just want to worship you. And we want everyone else to worship you too. So what we'd like you to do is sign a law that says, I mean, it's not a big thing. Nobody would probably do this anyways. But it's just to make sure. We want you to sign a law that if anybody prays to anybody but you, you kill them. That's all. I mean, people are probably praying to you right now anyways. Everybody loves you. You're great. Just sign this law, though. It's like, sure. Sounds great to me. I'm already pretty much God. Now everybody's just going to pray to me, and I'm just going to make sure. Sign it. Not a problem. Daniel knows that the law has been signed. Daniel is not oblivious to what's going on in the kingdom. He's about to be vice regent. Nothing happens in Babylon that Daniel does not know. He is very well aware of what was just signed. They didn't sneak this in on him. So it says, let's find the verse here. Verse 10 of chapter 6. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went to his house, his windows being open in his chamber towards Jerusalem. He kneeled on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks to God, thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. What this is telling you is that Daniel did not change his ways simply because the laws had changed. Daniel still would honor God. Laws may change, people, in our country. Right now they haven't. We have freedom, and be thankful for that freedom as long as we have it. But will you be resolved as Daniel, as he prayed as he always did before, if the laws come that forbid you from honoring God, that forbid you from worshiping God? Are we resolved to follow God in every situation? Now, he had his windows open towards Jerusalem because that's what King Solomon said to do, prayed towards Jerusalem. He was following David's example of praying 3 times a day. Not a requirement that we pray 3 times a day. He was making good habit of praying towards Jerusalem, as Solomon said, in the habit of David 3 times a day. And here's what's important. He had always done it. For 60 years, Daniel had been praying towards Jerusalem 3 times a day. Then they sign in a law that he's not allowed to do it anymore. Well, he's prayed for 60 years. Cut the guy some slack. You know what, Daniel? It's okay. Don't pray today. It's okay. You have been an honest praying man. It's okay. Just hide it. You've lived a good life, Daniel. Just make it to the... You're in your 70s. You really want to die like this? Just go with it. Just conform. Come on. It's not that big of a deal, is it, Daniel? You've prayed before. Martin Lloyd-Jones says, the problem isn't that men don't pray. It's that men don't continue to pray. Men don't continue to pray in those trying circumstances. When life gets hard, do you tend to forget about God? Do you go to what makes your life easier? Or are you resolved to pray to God still? Say, Lord, I don't know what's going on in my life right now in this world around me, but I do know one thing, that you are God, and I will worship you. Are we resolved like Daniel in that? You know what kind of attitude Daniel had? He had the same attitude of Moses. Hebrews chapter 11, when it speaks of Moses, says, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. For he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured as seeking him who is unseen. Daniel is seeking God as Moses sought God. The future reward of promise, the unseen God, that is what Daniel's focus is. And what's the result? We know this story. Daniel is taken and he's thrown into the lions. And actually what happens is Darius is frustrated. He stays up debating over and over whether he should actually throw Daniel in. But he's convinced, because he signed the law, he must throw Daniel into the lion's den. And Darius is distraught over this. He liked Daniel. Darius stays up all night, hoping that Daniel's not dead. And his son comes up, Darius runs to the lion's den. Daniel, are you there? Did your God protect you? Daniel's, yes, king, I'm fine. God is with me. And the result is that Daniel comes out of the lion's den and the conniving men were thrown into the lion's den and devoured because God had shut the lions' mouths. Now, how do these four stories really relate to resolve? Because you go back to those first two stories, it was small. It was eating some meat and drinking some wine, and no one would have said a word. Because all the other young boys that were there were doing what? They were eating the meat and drinking the wine. It was a very small, minor thing. They were in a new place. They'd just been captured. They were scared. Been easy to comply. But in their hearts, they were resolved to honor God in the little things. And then they were resolved to honor God instead of promoting themselves in the interpretation of dreams. So early on in their stages of their career and their life here in Babylon, their one focus in just the little minor things was to give God the glory and to honor God. And because they had learned to have resolve in the small things, they were then able to be resolved in the big things, where they were going to be killed. All four of them were going to be killed. But they were resolved to honor God first and foremost in their lives in the face of harsh danger and death. God was at the center of their agenda. The world is just like Nebuchadnezzar. It expects you to be fully on board, to follow, be an active part of, to accept the new standards of society and its rules. Satan is the god of this dark world. And he demands and he will force, he wants and he will tempt you to have implicit obedience to him and his darkness. Satan's going to set sin up in one form or another in front of you at some stage. And he's going to expect you to serve that sin. But we know as true followers of Christ that we have to cast off the bondage and the pressures of this world, because you have been set free by the blood of Jesus Christ, who has brought you into his kingdom. You are no longer a slave to sin. You are no longer bound to sin. But this means that we must be resolved to accept all the consequences that may come rather than worshiping whatever the idol of the hour is. Because that idol changes over and over. But God, whom we serve, does not change. The world demands that you yield to its mandates. Brothers, sisters, saints, I am telling you, as servants of the Lord Jesus Christ, we must refuse to do so. As Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, we also must refuse to bow. And we have to say, I will not bow down and serve other gods. We have to be like Daniel and continue to worship God even when we know the harm that it may bring. We must, in our lives, be resolved to follow God through every situation. Let's pray. Heavenly Father,